The Lifestyle Show, presented by Selena McKenzie.
Now, when Peter Bennett found himself in hospital, he began to keep a journal. This journal evolved into a humorous autobiography when his extended hospital stay started to bring back memories of his childhood in Liverpool. He joins us now. Welcome to the show, Peter.
Hello, Selena. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
I'm all right. And we live in a very small world because I'm sitting in a village in the centre of Northamptonshire. And you're, I think, in Malaga. And my son and his family live in Sottogrande.
Wow.
Which is south of you. And my three grandchildren go to school at San Jose College in Malaga.
It is a small world, isn't it? A very small world. Yeah, no Sottogrande. Well, it's a beautiful area.
Yeah. No, they've lived there for about 5 or 6 years. And the children, they're fluent Spanish, so...
And are Spanish they listening? Are they listening today?
I hope so, yes. Yeah, I hope so.
Well, tell us about the book then, because it's called A Bed With A View. And as we said in the introduction, it sort of started as a journal. So how did it evolve then?
I've had a long history and association with the medical profession. In the last 20-odd years, I've had, I think, 25 surgeries. So I've spent a lot of time in hospital, met a lot of doctors and nurses, and I had to go into hospital for quite a long time. So I know there were books written by doctors, quite famous books, Henry Marsh, Do No Harm, Adam Kay, This May Hurt, but I couldn't really find books written by a patient. So I got into hospital and decided that I would write a journal in real time about what was happening to me and how I was coping with the experience. So it's not actually a memoir. It's really a sort of real-time journal. So I recorded everything. If I spoke to a doctor or a consultant, I would tell them that I was writing it, and then they... I sort of gained their confidence a bit after a few weeks. And so they opened up about things that perhaps they wouldn't have talked about otherwise. And that gave me an insight into the structure of the national health, its strengths, and unfortunately its weaknesses. So that's how it came about. And also the experience in hospital, I found very challenging. Very challenging. So part of the book is quite depressive and dark because I did find the environment difficult to cope with. I mean, the lack of sleep, the food wasn't terribly good. And so gradually it causes you to be quite stressed, quite emotional. And that comes out in the book. Because the other thing that happened, interestingly and rather strangely, is, and I think other people have said this, that I started to hallucinate, I think because of the lack of sleep, and I was up a lot at night. I couldn't sleep very well. So, and then suddenly I'd have a sort of video of some time in my life as a child, a very clear video, which if you'd asked me before I went into hospital, I almost certainly would have said, I can't remember it. But in fact, these hallucinations were very clear. And so they're part of the book as well. So that's really what happened, and that's how it came about.
It's amazing, isn't it? The subconscious mind, the things you don't realise that you remember, and in times like that you do.
It is. It is. And some people say, I mean, I've talked to some doctors since, and they say that it's perhaps a way whereby we survive emotional stress. We survive by creating these videos in our mind, and they provide a sort of comfort or a distraction from what's happening to us. And I think prisoners who've been in solitary have said the same thing. They have these strange dreams which almost keep you going in a way.
Yeah, I'm sure. Did you say that it was an extended stay? You had to stay in longer than you expected?
I did, really, yeah. I went in, I've had a lot of problems with my sinuses, and I've had lots of sinus surgery. And my surgeon is, in fact, Spanish. He's Spanish. He's operated on me 10 times in the last 20 years. I call him the Picasso of sinuses. The man is a complete genius, and he's operated on me, and we have this major problem with the frontal sinuses, which are above my eyes. And so I went into hospital to have some surgery to try and clear these sinuses yet again. And unfortunately, I contracted a bacteria that was resistant to antibiotics. So it came a bit of a challenge to actually get rid of this bacteria. So what he did eventually was, because we couldn't get rid of it, he drilled two holes in my head.
Yeah,
and he put in two bolts with caps on the end of the bolts. And so what they would do is they'd open the bolts up and they'd pump stuff into the frontal sinuses to see if they could clear the infection. So that's what they were doing. And interestingly, one of the senior virologists who was looking after me was, in fact, the lady who invented the COVID vaccine in this country.
That's incredible. Are you okay now?
I'm all right now. Yeah, I still have some problems. But as a friend of mine has said, he said, you should give your body to medical research when you die. You've managed to do it while you're alive.
That's a good point, actually, with all those surgeries. Yeah, very good point. So as far as the NHS is concerned, I mean, there was mixed bag. I think they were brilliant during COVID. Since then, we've had bad reports about the NHS. How did you find it? Were there some good points while you were in there?
Yeah, I think what we've got to do is, I've spent my life in business. I was a solicitor for many years, and I've been in business, and I've sort of interacted with small companies, startups, and very big companies, public companies. And I think what we've got to do is to remind ourselves that we're talking about two completely separate entities. The NHS is a government-owned organization, run and by government, and it's an organization that employs hundreds of thousands of doctors and nurses. So the two categories are completely separate. So you've got to look at the NHS as an organization. Is it well run? I don't think it is. Is it well managed? No, it isn't. And then you've got to look at doctors and nurses who are incredibly talented, doing remarkable work. I mean, we live in this age of modern medicine, when we can have a new hip or heart surgery, all these extraordinary things. So you've got this group of people who are incredibly talented, who work incredibly hard, and to a great extent, they've lost the power, the control over their environment. It's been taken over by the management. So the management now dictate what happens. The government, they make policy on a macro level. And as one consultant said to me, when a politician stands up in parliament and rather self-righteously says, we're giving another $5 billion to the health service, the consultant said that not one single penny will reach the shop floor. So My sort of understanding became the politicians and the management are completely detached from the doctors and nurses, completely detached. The managers never appear. Politicians are sort of hundreds of miles away making these huge decisions, which a lot of the time the doctors and nurses don't agree with. So the power has been taken away from the doctors and nurses. So I'll give you a simple example. The NHS subcontracted cleaning out to a subcontracting company. So the cleaning is done by this company. In my particular ward, the cleaner was undoubtedly the laziest man that world has ever created.
Oh, dear.
And he would sort of lurch up and down the ward with the brush, in a sort of coma, really. I thought he might be meditating, but he was in a sort of coma. He wouldn't really go near the bed because I think the brush was probably frightened of them. But So the toilet wasn't clean for 6 days.
Oh, no.
Yeah, so it was an absolute mess. I started to clean it because I thought, you know, give me something to do. But anyway, the cleaners are subcontracted. So I'd say to the nurses or the sister or doctors, and I'd say, well, why can't you do anything? And they'd say, well, we can't because we have no power. We have no control over it. It's controlled by the management, who we never saw. I did see one chap one day, but we never saw the management. So there is this sort of loss of control on the shop floor. And of course, the people who understand the patients better than anybody are the doctors and the nurses. They're doing it every, you know, they're front of house, they're doing it. The management and the politicians are nowhere to be seen. And that, I think, is the fundamental problem.
It must be very frustrating for them, for the nurses and doctors.
It's very frustrating. And that came over. And the other thing that came over, because after a few weeks, the doctors and nurses sort of opened up to me because I said, well, this book is going to be anonymous, so nobody will ever be mentioned. The hospital isn't mentioned. And so they would tell me about, you know, their fears and their worries. And there was undoubtedly a fear of management. Even with consultants, they knew, the doctors and nurses, that their career could be undermined by management. The management, there's a case recently in this country about whistleblowers and how the NHS management try and stop whistleblowers from blowing the whistle. Mm. And when you read about it, it's a bit like the mafia. I mean, it's like mafia control. You know, they will make these people's lives an utter misery. They'll try and ruin them financially with legal proceedings, etc., when these people have got genuine concerns about what is happening.
Yeah.
And this, I think, is the fundamental problem. The NHS as an organisation is run and managed by politicians, and that is completely separate from these wonderful people who are doing extraordinary things, working a 13-hour shift. I mean, it's remarkable sometimes when you look at what they do.
Yeah, indeed. It's quite shocking to hear things like that. Sadly, we're running out of time, but I just wanted to ask you a little bit about your backstory, because I've got a double-edged saw here. I've got, you were a successful lawyer, but a failed comedian.
Yes, I was. Ah. Yeah. I'm a Scouser. I was born in Liverpool, and I attempted to become a comedian, which didn't work out terribly well. Do you want me to tell you quickly what happened?
Yes, do.
All right. I'll tell you what happened. I was born in Liverpool, grew up, studied law in Birmingham, went back to Liverpool, was unemployed, met a guy in the pub, and he said he was a comedian. It was quite strange because he wasn't in any way funny. But he said to me one day, did you ever do any public speaking? I said, well, I spoke at university. So he said, well, I've got a double booking next Thursday. Can you help me out? So I said, oh, yeah. So the next day he rang up and he said, the fee's 30 quid, 30 minutes, leave a bit extra because you might want to, they might want a bit more. So I looked the address up and I thought it was at the university. So I adapted T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland to a sort of satirical review of university life. So I went to the I went to what I thought was the venue, and unfortunately, it wasn't. And so a guy said to me, he said, no, it's not here, mate. There's another address down the road. So anyway, I go down the road, and the actual address is the Naughty Nipples Club. And Gentleman's Club in the darker side of Liverpool. So I went in and met Kenny Lane, the leader of Liverpool Comedy, who ran the club. And so Kenny and I sort of had a chat, and the fee was 20 quid. And I thought, well, I've got to get out of this somehow. But then I thought, well, if I leave Kenny now, I'm probably not going to walk again or have children. You know, it was that type of place. So anyway, we went on and introduced me, and he said, delighted to introduce a young comic who is in the line of Ken Dodd, and all the great Liverpool comics like Jimmy Tarbuck. He's a rising star, and we're great to have him here tonight to entertain you lads. So I go on, and I'm so nervous, I can't stand up. So I grab the mic. I grab the mic and I start my T.S. Eliot piece, and a bloke at the back shouts, expletive deleted, "What the is that about?" And he throws an ashtray and he hit. I saw it coming and I turned and it hit me behind the ear, knocked me unconscious.
No. So I
come round in Kenny's lair next to the stage. And all I can hear is the mob rioting and Kenny yelling at them, "If you lot don't quiet down, I'll bring that bloody comedian back on." Kenny came backstage and I'm bleeding heavily. Oh, and so no. I said, "Have you got any paper?" He said, "After that, mate, you're not getting any paper." So I said, "Can you get somebody to take me to the hospital?" He said, "You know, I'm not taking you to the hospital. You walk into the bloody hospital." And so I went to the hospital, had diagnosed with concussion, 10 stitches, and got on the bus to go home. And I realized, firstly, that I'd left my script, the T.S. Eliot adaptation, one of the great works of English literature, had been lost. And secondly, Kenny had given me 20 quid. So I went in my pocket. I thought, oh, God, at least I got 20 quid. But alas, Kenny had been smarter than I had imagined. And while I was unconscious, he had retaken his 20.
I knew you were going to say that. That's funny. Oh, Peter, you shouldn't be a failed comedian. You should be a comedian. That's fantastic. All this and more for our listeners is in the book called A Bed With A View. You can buy it right now from our website, tre.radio. And it's by the lovely Peter W. Bennett, who does a very, very nice Liverpudlian accent as well as a lovely normal voice, normal speaking voice. Peter, it's been a delight. Thank you for being on the show today.
Selena, thanks so much indeed.
My pleasure. God, good luck with the book. Bye-bye.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.